Dr. John Mack, October 1929, September 2004. John Mack was a man. John Mack was an explorer. He sought the truth. He chose, for reasons we'll never know while we reside on this planet, to search among ideas of the most bizarre. What led him to attach himself to such strange ideas, the most strange? His entire consciousness belonged to a realm of ideas, a most subtle realm of knowing, about beings who come from an unknown place to communicate with us in our arrogant yet fragile humanity. John Mack courageously chose to magnify and yes, challenge a humanity that says we are alone in the immensity of the cosmos. Each step he took, each word that he wrote, spoke of this thing of the most bizarre. Not only did he challenge this worldview, John Mack chose to advance ideals that sought to crumble every known assumption of who we are. He chose, for some unknown reason, to raise this knowing to a cosmic level, bringing us, yet to this day, into contact with something few of us dare to admit, a not-so-subtle intrusion in our own reality. We are not alone. Somehow fate, or a single being of all-knowing, has chosen to have John Mack make the passage from this physical world into another awareness, another journey, leaving many of us behind to continue in his work. John need not explore now. John need not question any longer. He sought the truth. An explorer no longer. Now John Mack knows the truth.
He was just staring. Mm-hmm. And we, like, tried not to look at him, because he was quite scary.
What was scary about him?
His big eyes, I think. I think they want people to know that we're actually making harm on this world, and we mustn't get too technologized.
What gave you that feeling?
I don't know.
But it came through to you when you were with the... With the strange being?
Yeah. When he was looking at me.
When he was looking at you?
Yeah. It came through my head.
Did it, like, through words or?
My conscience, I think.
Your what?
My conscience.
It came
told...
through your conscience told you?
While the thing was looking at me.
While it was looking at you, your conscience told you that. Had you been a person that had thought a lot about what we're doing to the Earth before that?
No, only after this.
Only after this.
John Mack in Zimbabwe talking to a young girl, a student at Ariel School in Zimbabwe that had a UFO land in its playing fields. An object seen by many children while teachers were inside having a staff meeting. John Mack was killed in London by a drunk driver this week. A professor at Harvard University, a professor of psychiatry, and a man who really put his neck on the line in investigating the abduction phenomenon. And a man who was taken from us very, very suddenly, and as far as many, many people in the UFO research field are concerned, far too soon. There was still very much to do. And the words that you heard a few moments ago, written and spoken by Victor Vigiani, regular contributor to this program. Also joining us in studio tonight, Michael Bird, who's the Central Canada Director for the Mutual UFO Network. And both of you had spent time with John Mack in public forums and in private, particularly Victor Vigiani, a man who's strangely dedicated to doing this way out of left field thing for a professor of psychiatry, it would seem.
I think that's probably true, Errol, because the sense that I got from him in meeting him the number of times that I did is that I'm not quite sure if he chose this himself or it chose him. And I have a sense that in some way it chose him. And in listening to John initially and reading his material way back when he first started to examine the phenomenon and develop the confusion in his own mind that he had, where is this coming from and why is this happening? I think it hit him in the right between the eyes, and he just had to grab it. He had to grab a hold of it to the point where he said, I just have to take this risk. I have to be in the present, as Michael said to me earlier. I have to be in the present with this thing. I have to look into it. It's an imperative for me. And in the time that I spent with him, no matter how you broach the issue with him, it always came back to the meaning of what was really going on. He was compelled to try to find out, at the risk of his own career, and you mentioned that earlier in the program, that it almost seemed like he would stop at nothing to get at what was going on. It took a truck to stop him, unfortunately. And the work that he began and continued to be compelled by is not going to be stopped by a truck. He started something rolling, started something moving that is just not going to stop. And there have been a lot of people in this whole field who've taken on the issue itself, not just of UFOs necessarily, but of how this thing hits us. Where does it come from? What does it mean once it's here? And its effect on the planet. And I think he started something rolling that is just unstoppable. And you disagree or agree with his positions on certain things, whether the benevolence of these beings be what they are or if they're a threat to us, that's not the issue. John was trying to get at the fact that we have been opened up to something. What that something is for the rest of humanity to figure out itself. And I think he gave us a good start. He gave us a fantastic start. He gave us a real challenge. And I think it's up to all of us to kind of take what he started and continue, because he'd be very upset if we just let the ball drop. And we cannot drop the ball. It's up to all of us to continue the work and to celebrate what he did. And I think we shouldn't really mourn the death. I mean, as tragic as it is, we all meet an end at one point or another in this short period of time that we have on the planet. But we can't stop here, and I think he would want us to continue. He would want us to move forward in the pursuit of trying to figure out what this means to humanity.
No matter how many brick walls we run into.
We're going to get bruised along the way, but we've got to keep going.
One of the ways that I set out to try to see what was going on around this was to study the phenomenon in other countries where presumably the Western media had not found their way, where cultures had not been subjected to the kind of technological barrage of information, so it couldn't be said, well, this is part of the high-tech, the UFOs and abductions and the medical surgical intrusions are somehow part of our high-tech culture. So I've gone around to many countries, Brazil, Southern Africa, Australia, to native peoples in this country. And I would like to be able to say I can make some kind of generalization. Yes, everybody has alien abductions just like us. Well, it's not that simple. I thought that might be true when I met Credo Mutwa in South Africa, who I'll show you on the video here, because his abduction experience was very classical. But then among native peoples, it seems that often the abductions take a form which is shaped to a great degree by the culture. I thought that I would find a really, really remote part of the world and then see whether some groups that had not been subjected to the media had the same experiences. So when I was in Australia in January, we got permission to go to a very remote part of Arnhem Land, which is an Aboriginal territory to the northeast of Darwin, where you have to get special permission to go, and the only way to get in there is by boat or by a single-engine plane that lands on a red gravel runway, and We had no idea. We brought in, you know, mosquito netting. We had no idea where we were going to sleep, my colleague and I, and we get to this little kind of, we didn't know what kind of village it would be, and there's these huts which have tin roofs, which was better than we had expected, and the man in charge of speaking with foreign intruders like us comes up to us, and my colleague Dominic Kalmanopoulos starts to explain to him, and cautiously, that this Dr. Mack, he works with people who have experiences with beings that come from the sky, and he said, "Oh, alien abductions, X-Files, we watch this on television every week." So, we looked at each other and we said, "So much for remote."
The voice of the late John Mack. Mike Bird, where was he speaking there?
That was in 1996 in Greensboro, North Carolina at the MUFON Symposium.
And you were there?
I was there, yes, I was in the second row. And just an amazing man. I feel very privileged to have known him since 93. It was the first time I saw him at another MUFON Symposium. When I first saw him, I actually didn't know anything about him at the time. But very shortly thereafter, I actually tried to get in touch with him. I did. I called him, and I'm not sure if friends is the right term, but we became associates over the ensuing years. I totaled up. I've actually bumped into him physically 8 times since 93. It was a large part either going to a conference or driving to Boston.
Yeah.
Victor will vouch for driving to Boston through a snowstorm to hear John Mack and Bud Hopkins was quite a challenge. But we made it. I'm going to miss his humor, his intellect, his compassion, his humanism.
When the rumor first started to come up, I think it was Monday night. I got an email, I guess around 11 o'clock on Monday morning, and I thought, no, I'm going to let this go. And then I got another email asking me if I'd heard the rumor. So then I sent Will Boucher, who was his assistant down there in Boston, an email saying there were rumors circulating that John Mack had been in an accident in London. And he immediately replied and said, "Call me back," which I did. And he broke the news to me. And he said, talking about his compassion, he said the house in Boston had a completely furnished apartment in the basement where all kinds of people, whether they be friends or colleagues, always stayed. Was an open house there. Whenever you were in Boston, you went to John Mack's house and you had somewhere to stay. That was an interesting, that was the main memory and the main concern of Will Boucher at that moment was, what's going to happen to this now, that whole space that was John Mack's home?
When I first heard, Michael called me at home, and I just couldn't believe it. It honestly felt like I'd lost a family member, and I'm not sure why. He had a way of opening his arms to you, and the day that I met with him in his Cambridge office, in 96 when I went down there, very humble office, he had a few clients come and go in, and he said, "Come on in," and we sat and we just chatted for well over 2 hours, and he just had a way of welcoming you and making you feel right at home. But yet, there was also this thing about him, too. He had this look in his eyes, this intensity in his eyes. He could almost stare right through you. That's the first thing that I noticed. It was something that you had to think about it. You had to think very, very closely about what you were saying because he hung off every word you said. He was an excellent listener. And the discussion that I had with him initially was about the work that I'd been doing in meeting the children and so on in the school system. And he asked me what my political capital was. And I didn't know what that meant.
I was going to say, did you figure out an answer?
You're right, a political capital. So it was a real challenge for me to figure out that and then to go on with the conversation.
Victor Vigiani and Mike Bird of the Mutual UFO Network here in Canada in studio tonight paying tribute to the late Professor John Mack of Harvard University and researcher into abductions, UFO abductions, alien abductions.
I really want to stress one particular idea, which is that to be more effective, to empower ourselves in this work, we need to have a philosophical framework that's somewhat broader than the one that we've been operating by up until this time. We run into a great deal of resistance in the public in doing this work. I think some of that has to do with the nature of the phenomenon, but I think it also has to do with the way we approach it. We're dealing with a matter here that's not just about data. I mean, it's very important to do the kind of excellent work we've been hearing about today to develop a database that is solid, that is authentic, that we can count on. But this is not just about science. We're dealing with a battle over worldviews here. And we're engaged in something which is fundamentally challenging to the dominant worldview that we have grown up in, which I call anthropocentric materialism. In other words, by this worldview, we have placed ourselves at the top of the intelligence hierarchy in the cosmos. We've restricted out of our consciousness.
The voice of Professor John Mack, former professor of psychiatry at Harvard University, who unfortunately was killed by a drunk driver in London, England, on Monday night. In the small hours, he'd been out to dinner after delivering a lecture to the C.E. Lawrence, who was known as Lawrence of Arabia. John Mack wrote the definitive biography of Lawrence of Arabia and won a Pulitzer Prize for it. So John Mack, a man of many, many, many talents, some of which we'll never get to discover now.
I think that last clip that we just heard, I think if you really distill just about everything that John talks about, that the statement of battle over worldviews, when you distill everything down to what he's really talking about, that's what I think the switch point is for me. That what he was introducing was a concept that so challenged the dominant worldview, the political and economic worldview, and even the spiritual mindset of people, that most people found it very, very difficult to accept the notions that he was advancing. And he was very adamant all the time about this battle over worldviews and his fight with science. Was it Harper who said to him not to worry about science, that science would learn its lessons soon? Mike, how did he put it? Do you recall?
Oh, I remember one line he said, it's not about science, it's about knowing, but I don't know who it came from.
Yeah, I think there was a sociologist or a political scientist that the name just doesn't come to me right now. But he really challenged science and the scientific method, that once science deals with things that are beyond its capacity, beyond the physical realm, then it runs out of space. It doesn't have too much to say about things that are non-physical. It can't explain the non-physical world. The non-physical world being the world of what he called the subtle realm. And once science attempted to try to explain that, it was going beyond its mandate. That's the basic battle of worldviews that I think he really fought. And he fought it well. I don't know how successfully he's fought it in the long run, but I think that's one of the things that we have to understand, is that this isn't just about data and about the collection of sightings. And we need to know all that stuff, there's no doubt about it. But it means so much more than just a collection of data and lights in the sky. There's a real political agenda here at work. And I think if we do listen to some of the words that he spoke in the last CD that you mentioned, Michael, about politicizing the issue, I think that's where John was going next with this whole thing. And perhaps we could talk about that on future shows, but right now the politics of that is, I don't know if that's germane at this point, but that's where I see him moving, because once you get into challenging a dominant worldview, you get into challenging the economics and the political structure of how the world works. And when you start engaging those forces, you're in for a real fight. And that's where I think John brought us to that point. And I think a lot of the other researchers have done that too. But I think John, in his capacity as a Harvard psychiatrist, he brought us to that point. And I think it's up to us to extend those notions of how this whole intrusion from the subtle realm is going to affect us from this point on. And what are we going to do about it? Are we just going to let it sit there and let his words and his work just sort of be something that becomes part of history that no one acts upon? Or do we do something about it now? Do we begin to really politicize the issue ourselves? That last clip really says it all for me, that it really talks about how we have to expand the notions of how this stuff meets us. It's not just a matter of a physical craft coming in and us seeing it. It means so much more than we really know.
Well, there's been a lot of people have been saying that for a while. Certainly John Keel and a lot of the old-time researchers who've passed now, the guys who are actually really out there doing the work and doing the research.
Even the beginning works of Jacques Vallée allude to all of that, because it meant, for Jacques Vallée, it wasn't just a matter of nuts and bolts, these things just sort of flying from some place in space to this place here near Earth. I remember that's the first work that I ever read by Jacques Vallée, and I was struck by the notion that this could mean something more than just nuts and bolts, because I was convinced that in my initial thinking about this, that this is just, you know, craft that come from someplace else, and you know, that's about it. And you see it. But what we hear from the people who have been taken and all of the other evidence that the anecdotal evidence that we have, there's something more to it. And I think you said it earlier that all this stuff comes together. It's not just a physical thing. It's how the non-physical meets the physical world. And that gap that's created is narrowing very, very quickly. We think there's a huge gap between the physical and non-physical world, but that gap is narrowing. I think John Mack brought us to the point where that gap is narrowing so finely that it's about to flip. And we're all going to realize at some point in time that this is just not a physical thing that's happening. It's almost a consciousness alteration, altering our consciousness about thinking about who we are as physical beings.
As in mind shift.
Yeah, mm-hmm. A real mind shift.
Yeah, real mind shift. Let's play another clip. You want to set this one up?
This is where he talks about UFOs crossing over from one realm to another.
I remember some years back there was a debate between Ram Dass and Daniel Ellsberg, both very spiritual beings of the Pentagon Papers, and they had this argument. They said, Ram Dass was saying, well, if we transform ourselves and go deep and become spiritually evolved beings, that's the way to approach the threat of nuclear war, which was the uppermost threat. And Dan Ellsberg says, yeah, but if we don't do something now, we're going to be dead. And, you know, it's the old thing, if a child has a 106-degree fever, you got to soak them in cold water and give them aspirin at the same time that you're taking blood to find out what the pathogen is. So some kind of action is required of us. But again, it's frightening and we have to be strategic and see it's easy to withdraw and say the political, I just can't deal with the political thing. It's like, I can't relate at that level. And I respect that. But if we don't relate at that level, we are not going to be here very long.
The problem with the UFO phenomenon is that it is not one thing or another. I find when I do this work around the world, there are very few generalizations that hold up. The grays exist in the same form all over the world. Something like this occurs. When we were in South Dakota, the Lakota Sioux talked about coming from the star people. But they don't necessarily mean the same thing by the star people that we mean by the grays, even though some of them have had experiences that look like classical abductions. I've interviewed Cherokee medicine people. Again, they're familiar with abductions being taken up into enclosures, and yet it is shaped to a degree by the culture. The taxonomy of beings is not the same as we have identified in Western ufology. But as Harper says, we haven't reached the point yet where we trust the primary data of human experience. Alfred North Whitehead was one of the few philosophers who felt that science should base its whole realms of knowledge upon the data of human experience, because that is ultimately what we are dealing with. The UFO phenomenon is strange, though. It crosses over. It manifests in the material world. It shows up in the language that we know of the physical world, but it does not necessarily seem to be of the physical world. We think that astronauts have something to tell us because perhaps they've seen UFOs as extraterrestrial craft in space. But Edgar Mitchell told both John Carpenter and myself that no astronaut has ever seen a UFO in space. They've seen them here in the Earth's atmosphere. But to Mitchell and other astronauts, these are not vehicles like aircraft that are simply nuts and bolts objects that come through the distances of space. They are something else, and we know not what that is.
John Mack was killed in London late Sunday night. I missed the whole conference at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which was quite a phenomenal event because there were people from all walks and all professions who came and gathered together. And Cordy Bryan, C.D.D.B. Bryan, wrote the book on that. He went there as a skeptic. And it seems to me that John Mack was a major influence on Cordy Bryan in changing his mind.
In reading the book that Bryant put out, I think the foreword and in the first chapter of it, he stated very clearly that he went there with a very severe bias against the belief of the abduction phenomenon and all of it. But I think that one of the things that happened was that in true anecdotal form and not scientific data got through to this journalist, to this writer, and literally changed his mind. So doing a 180-degree turn on the basis of anecdotal information, hearing people talk about this. And I think that's where John is coming from. And he said that very clearly in the last two clips that we played. The point that I tried to make earlier is this is not just about science, about data. We have to listen to people, to people's stories about this. And that's where we glean our information. That's where we obtain the way of knowing. He talks about how all of this stuff seeps into our language, our epistemology, our way of knowing. Science does not necessarily influence language in the way we process information. They may have observations about it, but we as human beings see things and we talk about them. And in a court of law, as an example, a witness sees an accident or a crime in place, and that testimony can send someone to the electric chair. Yet in UFO examination, ufology, someone sees a UFO and is branded a saucer head. You can see the imbalance of human anecdotal information. It's just simply not believed because it's in a realm of unbelievability. It's not something that our worldview will permit us. And if it does permit us to believe it, that means something, that the whole worldview of everything that we believe in has to change. That's the point I think that, that John and many of the other researchers make that point. If we believe or if we know that these things are in fact coming to us from someplace, from this other realm or whatever, if we accept that fact, then we have to believe a different paradigm of knowing. We have to use other kinds of language, other kinds of ways of knowing in order to, first of all, accept that. And then where do you go from there? What does that do to our worldview? It changes everything so drastically, and I think that's the way our language is. It's very slippery, and as soon as we begin to get into that kind of language, we slip into other ways of knowing, and that's one of the great things that I think John has done. He's such a master at using language, too, in that way.
Mm-hmm. John Mack had problems with Harvard University.
Most definitely.
They didn't want him around.
No, they challenged it, and they challenged him, and he challenged them. He could have very easily just backed off and said, okay, I'll go sell my wares someplace else, but he didn't. He stuck with it, and I think he had a good lawyer, too.
Well, Daniel Sheehan, who had defended Daniel Ellsberg in the Watergate papers, because Daniel Ellsberg was the one who blew the whistle on that whole Richard Nixon thing. He represented the family of Karen Silkwood, who was reporting on the nuclear power unsafe. Daniel Ellsberg was a wunderkind lawyer in the late 60s, and John Mack certainly chose wisely when he chose Daniel Ellsberg to be his legal counsel when he was having problems with Harvard University when they were trying to get rid of him for being into alien abduction.
Something that challenged the status quo within one of the big institutions in the United States, that and Yale University.
Mike Bird, we have a couple of minutes left. Any final thoughts?
He was the most remarkable man I've ever met and probably ever expect to meet, which is sad, but I feel quite fortunate that I at least got to meet him, got to know him. One thing I was trying to do as of late, I was actually trying to get John Mack and Noam Chomsky together. John was interested in doing that. I sent some stuff to Noam. I think he maybe now wishes that he had gotten through to John, but nonetheless, I think the real issue is that many, many people have to step up to the plate now. What John did was move the bar to a level that I think he took it as far as one man could take it. Many, many more will have to take it to the next notch. And I know Victor and I are planning for a UFO conference next September here in Toronto. And I'd like to think that the basis of it will be the political reality of UFOs. As Victor said, it's not about counting numbers anymore. We've got a mountain of data. But it's about establishing the fact that they're here, and what does that mean to our planet?